Konitz's sound has taken on weight and authority. He's always been free of cliches. His solos are full of secrets. Clear, bold-faced passages are followed by shadowy turns. These mysterious, always soft insertions give the impression that he's talking in two voices at once, to us and to himself. Unquote Whitney Balliet. Lee Konitz performed last night at the University of Delaware, and he's also in residence at Temple University this semester, where he's teaching once a week in their jazz program. Lee Konitz, it's a great pleasure to meet you. I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Since we just heard a 1955 session that you recorded with Lenny Tristano, why don't we start with your work with Tristano? First of all, do you remember the recording of the session that we've been listening to?
I can smell the Chinese food now. This was in a Chinese restaurant, and in between phrases, I had the sweet and sour ribs invading me. But I do recall the session. And in case it didn't say on the notes, which probably did, there were five tunes released originally, and 26 years later, the man from Atlantic Records called me and said they had 13 more tunes, and I was pleased to hear that. I didn't realize that they did. They came to the restaurant one night and recorded the whole evening, apparently. And so he sent me a cassette, and of course I was pleased. I think this is some of Lenny's most relaxed playing. And I heard you saying earlier from Whitney Balliet or whoever said this, that one of the reasons Tristano nixed this music was because of Art Taylor's drumming.
Well, I had said that was speculation on the part of a jazz critic. Is that true?
Well, I don't know, but I was always very pleased with the respect that Art paid for Lenny. Art, left to his usual situation, liked to bash a lot more and be, you know, more imaginative in his participation in the music. But he just kept straight time, basically, on this with Gene Remy, who was a beautiful man who recently passed away, I learned last week. They just play straight ahead. And I think that solidity to that straight ahead kind of beat allowed Lenny to kind of take pauses and things that sometimes he tended to kind of get a little more compulsive about, trying to fill up all the space.
Why did you first want to study and play with Lenny Tristano?
Because he was an interesting man doing interesting things on the piano with all five fingers of each hand, I guess.
Did he have a theory or a method that you could articulate that he passed on to you?
It was basically a very almost fanatic intention and respect for the music of jazz. He was a jazz scholar. That's what he did day and night. He read books from the Library of Congress, the talking book records for the blind. He was doing that constantly. In fact, he got to a point, he told me, where he was playing bass lines on the piano while he had the earphones on reading the book. And then one time I walked in and the record was playing that I could hear, and it sounded like, I said, what's happening? And he said, the book isn't very interesting, so I turned it up to the next beat. And he just managed to communicate and then instill a respect for the music and the people who played it and the procedures and the disciplines so that he was able to communicate that to anyone who was in earshot, and everyone almost that was a student became just very serious about the subject, fanatically so, to the point where they wouldn't go out into the workaday world and play in public. It was like a scholarly kind of activity.
Did he listen to you and say that there were certain things that you should keep and other things that he intended to change in your playing?
Well, no, he never gave me that kind of a look at the future of his procedures, but he just managed to acknowledge me in some way right from the very beginning when I didn't really know what I was doing and encouraged me to do more of that, almost to the exclusion of other things at that beginning stage when I was in my teens. So I avoided really listening closely to some people like Charlie Parker, who I later learned to love fully, because I didn't want to do what everyone else was doing at that time and sounding like Charlie Parker. And when I realized that I was just missing a great dimension in the music, then I got past that ego consideration.
What was a typical session like when you were taking a lesson?
Well, usually going through very basic assignments. Lenny was famous for giving the same lesson sometimes for 15 years. And so he'd say, okay, you're getting it. Work on it some more, and next week we'll listen to it again. And that could go on for years with some people. It was very basic materials, just being able to use the handful of materials that we have at our disposal, especially then, to be able to play as intelligently as possible. And from there, playing some and then talking about things, whatever, and just feeling enriched from the visit, you know.
I think he had people sing who were studying with him. Did he do that with you? Have you sing other people's solos and sing your own solos?
Man, I can sing like Frank Sinatra. He told me once I was living in the first floor of the estate he had in Queens in Long Island, and I used to sing along with my Frank Sinatra records, and he said, you ought to make a record. You sound good doing that. So I did that Pen Out Serenade, but I didn't use any lyrics and et cetera. But I was a recipient of that information. It's like I said today at the clinic at Temple, I give you permission now to swing. All right, you have my permission to just play what you feel and don't play anything else. All right, if you know what I'm trying to say, he told me, you can sing with the records. And I said, gee, thanks a lot. I never thought of that. So I did, and I still do.
Does it free up anything to sing? Does it free you up when you're singing and not limiting your music to your instrument?
Oh, yes. It's a total participation of one's physical being in a way, sometimes more so than playing the instrument. There's such an involvement with mechanistic things in playing an instrument. When you're singing, you just open up your mouth and it's all you, and somehow it can activate that musicality to a point where I recommend that we then do that on the instrument, try to duplicate that physical sensation.
Tristano was also famous after a while for trying to get his students to enter psychoanalysis.
That was part of the thing that I didn't participate. I wasn't really part of the cult. Well, I was to some extent early on, the cult aspect of that in-group kind of thing. Tristano was very involved in Wilhelm Reich's philosophy at that time. And his brother, actually, was practicing it and came from Chicago later on and was living in his house. And the students were going from a therapy session to a music session or the other way around. I never did that. I didn't seat well with me. But that is a part of what was happening, yes.
Was it expected that if you played with him that you were supposed to become a part of the cult? Did he resent that you weren't?
No, he knew I was a little odd and kind of not part of the group, and he went along with it, you know.
When did you know that it was time to leave and get out on your own?
Well, I knew it all the time, really, because I didn't identify as fully with the group. I just felt that I wanted to do different things. I wanted to work. I had a family at that time. I needed to work, and I liked to play. So when Stan Kenton called me and offered me a steady opportunity to play in a situation that I enjoy playing with a big band, that's not my preference, but he said he was really trying to get a jazz band together at that time, and I said, great, I'd like to try it. And, of course, I was kind of put down by the people in the organization who said I was kind of settling for less or whatever they said. And then I learned that they were the first ones to copy my solos from the records. So I forget what you asked me.
Oh, but when you knew it was time to leave.
I knew then it was time to leave.
Did you ever feel eclipsed playing in a band that was led by the person who was also your teacher and tried to have his students be not only students but disciples?
No, Lenny was very cool about that in many respects. And I think we all felt very free to take chances with him because he was really totally involved. And when he said, you know, play at a recording session some free music for 3 minutes, we had tried it and it felt good and we knew what he was referring to. But it wasn't planned. It was just like we felt like buddies and fellow musicians at that time. But he was the kingpin all the time.
One of the things that he did, and I think that you've been doing as well, is to have a body of standards that can be played over and over again and can be played differently all the time. How do you regard jazz standards? You know, like what makes a jazz standard worth playing for you, especially the ones that you, you know, interpret over again through the years?
They have, well, the jury is in on that material by now, certainly. It's good. There are good melodies with good harmonic progressions. And probably more than that by now, they're very familiar. I was talking today to the kids at the school as they had their fake books up in front of them about that phenomenon. You can't really improvise very well on material that you don't really know. And if you know it very well, you can improvise even better. So most of the people who could play well, especially in the early days when doing many different kinds of things wasn't really the way. If you played bebop, you were a bebopper to the end. And Charlie Parker played a handful of tunes, and Tristano played a handful of tunes. And I'm stretching out and playing more original materials now, but that familiarity, especially when you're standing up in front of a paying audience, really gives you some security. It takes a little bit of the mystery out of the process, because I still try to approach it from a new situation each time, and that's a little scary, you know. So knowing that you can predict the form in that respect and a good melody and chord progression to base it on helps the procedure.
Let's hear you playing a standard, and this is from an album that you recorded a few years ago with bassist Red Mitchell, and it's an album of Cole Porter songs, and we'll hear You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To. Do you want to say anything about recording duets or choosing to do an album of Cole Porter songs?
Well, that was a project that I have never really completed. I just wanted to finally know at least a dozen tunes of the great composers. Sometimes I play some tunes and I'm not sure who was the composer of it. It was a little embarrassing. So now I can say I know 11 tunes. We only did 11. We were going to do, the idea was 12 tunes in 12 different keys to do that whole number. And we found one in a relative minor key. It didn't come out to 12. It came out to 11. And I didn't get to the other composers yet. But playing with in a duo situation is one of my favorite situations. Red was interested in doing that, and he's a great one to relate to. He's such an infectious player. And so we had quite a nice long day of sitting and figuring out nice changes for these tunes and playing them. And also it was an opportunity for me, this is just for anyone who's interested in saxophonology, I was using a different kind of embouchure then, called a French double lip embouchure, where there's no teeth on the top of the mouthpiece, ladies and gentlemen. And so because Red is so relaxed and everything, and I could hear well enough, I was able to use that. And it's a different sound than you just heard on this last record. And of course, the music is different. And when someone said, how come you don't play like you play with Lenny Tristano? I say, because I'm not playing with Lenny Tristano. You know, it's different with each people.
Okay, let's hear alto saxophonist Lee Konitz with bassist Red Mitchell from an album of Cole Porter songs that they recorded together. This is You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To. Thank you. That was Cole Porter's You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To, played by alto saxophonist Lee Konitz with Red Mitchell on bass. And Lee Konitz is my guest today. He's currently in residence at Temple University, so he'll be in town once a week for the remainder of this semester. Well, you were telling us right before we heard that you used a different embouchure for playing in this, in which your lips instead of your teeth touch both sides of the reed. Do you play around with stuff like that a lot, with your embouchure or with the kind of reeds that you're using, and try to change your tone or change the way you play?
Yes. And you said something that wasn't quite right.
Oh, okay.
About the lips touching both sides of the reed. Is it?
Oh, both sides of the mouthpiece is what I meant. Well, the reed on one side, the mouthpiece on the other.
Okay. I didn't think you meant that. But I have tried to play in as many different ways that I know about, just for the fun of flexing. I was very fixed and rigid in many respects in my early training as a legitimate clarinet player, and that brings a very tight kind of grip on the mouthpiece for the kind of tone quality that you can get that way on a clarinet. And I brought that to the saxophone. I didn't know anything else to do that sounded good to me and felt good to me. And now I enjoy making different sounds. I think that's the saxophone, after all, is the most flexible of the instruments, and so not flexing on it seems like a loss somehow. So I enjoy doing that. It gets me in trouble sometimes because, it's easier to kind of do one thing and depend on it. So sometimes over the development of that, my tone has been kind of less than pure, maybe.
How important is practicing at this point in your career? You're an accomplished player. You're certainly not a beginner, but do you spend a lot of time off the bandstand just practicing and trying new things?
Yes, I do exactly what I've done from the beginning. I just like to play the saxophone or whatever I'm playing, but the saxophone definitely is my main instrument, and I play it every day pretty much because I like to do it for no other reason. I improvise, basically. I get nervous when I'm talking on the air sometimes. I fondle paper. I won't tap on the table, though. I know that you can hear that very well. But I enjoy doing that, and I expect that I will continue doing that right along. And if anybody cares about that.
Well, so your first instrument was clarinet and not saxophone. What did you switch from the clarinet to saxophone?
I included a saxophone the second year. My parents got me a tenor saxophone for Christmas of the second year when I was 12. And then a couple years later, I got an opportunity to play in a band, play the alto a few years later. And so I played the alto, and I liked that. It was less heavy and was easier to carry around. And I liked the sound of it, so I stayed with the alto.
What kind of music were you playing then?
I was playing with some groups in cocktail lounges in Chicago. there was a lot of that activity. It was during war years when a lot of musicians were away, and I was singing 3- and 4-part harmony with one band I was playing with in different lounges around Chicago, and getting to play jazz, and then playing with big so-called name dance bands. There was one called Teddy Powell. I followed Charlie Venturo into that band, and I didn't know a heck of a lot then, and Charlie Venturo was quite an accomplished player whom I had admired very much on the listening to in person and on the radio. And when I sat down to play his book and saw all those chord changes, and they were written in concert key instead of the key of the tenor sax, that was a tenor sax situation, I was really winging it, as they say. In fact, they told me that Teddy Powell walked off the stage after he heard me play the first solo and hit his forehead against the wall. And I heard there was a nail in the wall, so he banged his forehead on a nail, and I thought that was justification for it. That was good to that happened to him. But anyway, I got to learn that way. So as contrary to what exists now for young people, there isn't a lot of that opportunity, well, certainly to play jazz. But I guess there's a comparable opportunity for some of the more fusion rock type people to play and get their things together actively.
Well, when you were young and first playing in big bands, little did you know that there weren't going to be a lot of big bands around much longer. Were you prepared for the dissolution of the big bands?
I never intended to play with big bands. It wasn't that important to me. It's just something that is a good experience to have when it happens. But I'm more interested in improvising all the way.
Were there things that you had to play or people you had to play with when you were first playing professionally that you found hopelessly old-fashioned, but you knew you had to do it to make your living that week or to get the experience that you needed before you went out on your own?
I did very relatively little of that, bar mitzvahs and weddings and journeyman kind of work. I did some of that, and I wasn't fully qualified. You had to know a body of tunes, and this body of tunes usually was available. It was a catch-22, I guess, where you had to do the jobs to learn them, and I didn't do enough of them. So they would get someone, preferably. I was already getting known as a jazz kind of player, and so I've done very little of that kind of work. And most of the people I played with have been more creative people, and they're usually very tolerable. There have been people who have been who might not liked what I was trying to do and not been fully cooperative over the years. But overall, I've been very grateful to find people who were just trying to play like I was in their way. And sometimes we got together. Other times we could kind of coexist and not quite get together, but that's acceptable for a day's work.
One of the innovative big bands that you played with was the Claude Thornhill Band. How did you first get involved with that band?
Well, I'll tell you, on my way to Delaware 2 days ago, I sat down and a guy across the aisle said, "Aren't you Lee Konitz?" And he introduced himself as a trombone player that I met 30 or more years ago. And he was with a Lester Lannan. You ever heard of them? They were going to President Reagan's inaugural ball as one of the bands. And there were a bunch of musicians there. And I looked around and I saw a guy that looked familiar to me. And I said, "Is that Les Clark?" And he said, "Yes, it is." And I hadn't seen him 40 years. He and I worked together on a band called Jerry Wald was the name of this guy, who was an Artie Shaw-type clarinet player, had a nice band. And what was the question?
Joining the Claude Thornhill Band.
He told me on the train that he recommended me to the Claude Thornhill Band. He was on it and he was leaving, because up until then, 2 days ago, I didn't know how I got that job. Someone told me, I forgot. And someone, I did an interview a couple of weeks ago, and they asked me that question. And so, again, I was a little embarrassed of not having that information. He assured me that I got it because of his recommendation, and I thanked him formally 40 years later. It was 47, so 30, a long time ago.
The arranger for many of the pieces that the band played was Gil Evans.
Right.
Did those arrangements, did you enjoy playing those arrangements that were probably unlike other arrangements?
The band was the most beautiful ballad band imaginable. I imagine you must have heard it on a record at some time. In person, it was exquisite. Some nights I had literally goose pimples and tears in my eyes because it was gorgeous with two French horns and a tuba. And Gil's just magnificent voicings. It was an extraordinary experience playing with that band. And I think Whitney Balliot referred to the eccentric relationships I had in those years. It was hardly an eccentric band, although Claude tended to have a couple nips and get a little eccentric, but quietly so. So I wouldn't refer to that as an eccentric situation. I wouldn't refer to the Miles Davis Nonette as an eccentric situation, although there were eccentric characters in it. The music certainly wasn't eccentric. Tristano might have been quirky, as they say, but... Well, he tended to be a little eccentric later on, more so. He was quite a, you know, solid character in those days, I thought. Very respectable scholar, you know, he was a bright man. And Stan Kenton, who was also mentioned as an eccentric part situation, was bombastically eccentric at times, possibly. And he had large feet, and sometimes if I were downstairs and he tapped off a tempo, after I left the band, I was downstairs in one theater, and I heard him tap off a tempo, and it was a tip-off to me why some of the tempos were funny, because he was a tall man, and he really stomped off that tempo pretty hard. But anyway, one last thing I just recalled that from the notes you said before on Tristano. Whitney Balliot, I think, referred to him in an Art Tatum relationship. And Lenny learned from Art Tatum, but he didn't really play in an Art Tatum way at all, I don't think. Mm-hmm. He had the virtuosity, but he didn't display it as Art did, I think. He was much more a mainstream jazz piano player.
When you were coming of age during this period when... You played with the Claude Thornhill Band and Lenny Tristano and the Miles Davis Nonette and Stan Kenton. Did you feel that being white at all was going to affect which bands you could play with and which bands that you couldn't, or that being white was going to color, so to speak, the way people regarded your playing?
There were those considerations, and it was very disturbing at times. But I got a lot of acknowledgement right in the beginning. Miles Davis was a very... friendly person in my short association with him, and I got to play with a lot of good guys that accepted me in some way. I think they felt in some way that I was really trying to do whatever I could do and not any threat in any way. But there were times when I felt apologetic for trying to play that music, and I'm glad that that's over with, because it is a kind of a pain to have to think about that at all. I even canceled a job once, money I needed very badly, because I thought it would be an awkward situation to play opposite a band that I won't mention.
What would have been awkward about it?
Well, I think that I just wouldn't have been comfortable playing opposite another saxophone player. And so... it had something to do with that environment that I would have been self-conscious in, I thought.
Well, in jazz, the word white is sometimes used derisively. You know, he sounds really white.
Yeah. I said that last night to a saxophone player I was playing. Let me see how I can say this in case someone's listening. from Delaware. I don't know if I can say this, but in effect... let me see.
Is it four-letter words, or is it insulting to this person?
No, it had to do with this concept of I leaned over when the rhythm section, which was all white, was playing, and they weren't really comfortable. And I said, when a white rhythm section isn't swinging, they really ain't swinging. And so it was something like that.
My guest is alto saxophonist Lee Konitz, if you're just joining us. And he performed last night at the University of Delaware and is in residence this semester at Temple University, where he'll be teaching once a week in the jazz program. Let's listen to one of your recent records, and then we'll continue our discussion. And we were talking a little earlier about the importance of singing as well as playing, and how that frees you up.
Yeah.
We're going to hear something in which you actually do sing on, although I don't know if you sing in concerts at all. I've only seen you perform once, and I don't think that you sang during that.
No, not usually. I used to sing like the blues and like Al Hibbler and Billy Eckstein when I was in Chicago as a youngster, and something happened and I stopped doing that. I got inhibited or whatever. But I've always liked to sing, and at this particular date, excuse me, I'm having a little problem here. I enjoyed the setting in a penthouse studio so much. While we were waiting for the piano player to arrive, the bass player and I were standing at the microphone. I'm going to have to excuse myself again and take a sip of this because I'm going to cough.
Okay. Well, if you want, you can tell us a story after the record.
Great.
And good. So why don't we hear the record? This is Penthouse Serenade from a recent Lee Konitz record called Dovetail. And Harold Danko is at the piano, Jay Leonard on bass.
Ba da da ba da da ba ba da ba da ba ba da 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 la la da da ba da da ya da 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 ya da 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 ba da 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 e da da e la la e ya da 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 la da da la da 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 dia ba da da dia la dia e da 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 ba da ba da 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 ba da la da 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 la e e da e la da e la e da 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 dia e da e a e a e a e da e a da 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 e da e da 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 ya da 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 ah da 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 la di a di da di la da da la e a da 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 e a e a e a e da 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 ya da 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 ya da 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 ya 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 da 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 ya ya da 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 ya da ya ya da ya da da di ya da 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 di ya da da di da 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 ya 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 da ya da 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 da.
From the album Dovetail, that was Lee Konitz singing, along with Jay Leonard on bass. And the album, again, is called Dovetail. Alto saxophonist and composer Lee Konitz is my guest in the studio. You were telling us the story of that session.
I stopped choking to death and try it again. So the Harold Danko hadn't arrived yet, and I felt like doing something. And I said, looking over the East River out of this beautiful penthouse studio, do you know Tajay Lenhart, this lovely bass player, who is a fine singer himself? I said, do you know Penthouse Serenade? And this was a tune that I had heard all my life. I hadn't really ever played it, to speak of. And he said, yeah, what key? I said, well, I don't know, E. And so he, 1, 2, 3, 4, and we did it. And I saw his eyebrows raise when he saw what I was doing. And that was the intention. It was a nice gesture. I thought maybe that could be some little thing that I hadn't done before on a record for this lovely man who had this record company, Sunnyside Records. And I was playing with the paper again. I'm sorry about that. Would you take this paper away?
Okay. We're talking about how when you play with paper, it makes noise on the radio because the microphone picks it up.
Did you know the one about Mel Brooks and Kyle Reiner? It opens with Mel Brooks as a psychiatrist saying, get out of my office. You got a dirty mind and a dirty mouth and whatever. And Kyle Reiner says, what's the matter? And he says, she eats paper. He says, can you help her in that situation? He said, yes. He said, how do you help someone who eats paper all the time? He said, I say, don't eat no paper anymore. Things like that. See? Anyway, I did this and told him to leave it on the record. And a year or so later, there were various reviews, and no one was enraptured by my singing, although I got one vote for Grammy Award, I heard. I didn't win.
Do you feel somewhat naked when you sing because you don't have the horn in front of you?
Yes, indeed. It's a very much more personal thing in a way. Less in another way, I suppose, but personal in the sense that it's just you involved in it. But I accepted it for that kind of thing as a spontaneous gesture, okay, not as a prepared vocal rendition. And some guy, and this is just a comment on critics per se, a man named Mike Hennessy, a British man who's very clever and very good writer, I think, reviewed the record. And they sent me the review, and he said, in effect, that he used a bunch of words like he proposes a society to interdict nugatory conit singing. I think those were the words. And I looked up nugatory, and I looked at the first letters of each of those words, and it said stinks. I said, God. And so forth. And then I listened to the record again, and it sounded different to me. He told me that there was something wrong with it. And I listened to it, and I said, I shouldn't have done that and let it go out on a record. It's really not that skillfully done or whatever. And I didn't enjoy it for the first time.
Now, well,
what is
now?
That? And so the next day, I listened to it again, and I said, there it is. That's all it was, and it was that. And I don't like that guy for saying that. I'm going to cough again, so goodbye.
Okay. You have, I think, 5 children, right?
Somewhere, yeah.
That must have made it tough when you were first getting started, and even afterwards. It costs a lot to raise 5 children, and jazz is not always the most lucrative of professions. Did you find yourself making decisions about how you were going to run your artistic career in spite of the fact that you had 5 children? Because there must have been a lot of temptation to, get a day job or...
Well, that's partly the reason that I accepted the job with Stan Kenton. Even though it took me away, it meant that I could provide for them a little better, more consistently than I did. But that was sort of a tragedy in my life, that whole situation, and not being able to really raise the family properly, and then I left when the oldest child was 10. I was separated and divorced from my wife, so it was a tragedy in my life that was due partly to the inconsistencies of this way of life. I was determined to try to learn the music so I could fulfill the encouragement that I had been getting, and I was obsessed with that. This is a public confession, folks. And so I just went along with it, and I was very sad that I was unable to continue being part of the family.
Well, it's hard to choose, isn't it, between your artistic obsession and other personal commitments?
Well, at times it seems like there's nothing quite as important because there are so many more people involved than the few that you're living with. And it's a weird way to look at things, but it is a real perspective sometimes. I go out there all the time, and there are thousands of people nodding and saying they feel better because they heard those few minutes of music. And, you know, to be able to handle all of that just requires a very mature person. And in order for a person to be mature, one of the requisites is that he has a kind of a job where he's able to feel that kind of dignity and not be a second-class kind of nomad, as most of us are in one way or another, especially, I guess, especially in jazz in some way, because it's still not given the same accord that the rest of the art forms are.
You've taught a lot as well. Do you think that your teaching is similar to the teaching, to the style that you were taught in by Tristano?
Yes, of course. The main elements of that are still very valid, and I must pass them on.
Why don't we listen to a record, and then I'll give you a chance to have some more tea. I hope you're not catching a cold or anything.
No, not at all. I don't even like that word. This is just, okay. I talked for 3 hours already before I even saw you, so I'm sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. Well, let's listen to a selection from your new No Net record, and No Net is a band with 9 pieces in it. And
actually, what it means is we take such chances and we use No Net.
Okay, we're going to hear Without a Song, which features your arrangement. Do you want to briefly introduce it for us?
Well, this is a record that was released by a very lovely man in Milano, Italy, who has a very successful label in jazz called Black Saint and its affiliate Soul Note. This is from a concert that we did in Holland a few years ago. And Signor Bonandrini bought this tape from the Dutch radio. And this is an arrangement that was recorded previously in a studio on another label, but it happens to be one of the tunes we did there. It's based on Without a Song. And it's, well, I don't know if you're going to have time to play the whole thing. There's a nice kind of a unison section in the front and a nice piece in the back. I guess we'll just hear the front.
Yeah, I think we probably won't have time for
the whole
piece. You
have to buy the record, folks. It has a beautiful collage on the cover by my wife, and it's well worth the $100 or so that it costs. I don't know how much it costs these days.
So this is Lee Konitz and his No Net Live at Laren is the name of the album. This is Without a Song, arranged by Lee Konitz. Thank you. From the latest Lee Konitz No Net album, that was Without a Song, as arranged by my guest, alto saxophonist and composer Lee Konitz. With what you did with Without a Song, you probably could have given it your own title, don't you think? Because you weren't exactly arranging the melody there. You were arranging your own melody to the chord changes, really. It was pretty...
But the first part was all melody.
Yeah.
I could have left that out, certainly, but I wanted that as part of the arrangement. Sometimes there are greater things than money, I found out. So I don't know what they are at the moment, but that's one of them. Just getting a finished product that kind of is in balance in some way. I'm very sorry that we had to fade that out because I liked the last part of this thing, but I guess we're going to play another. Are we going to get to play one of those duet records? I wanted to play a couple minutes of that if we have time.
No, I think we're not going to. We only have about 3 minutes left.
Really?
We have to join the network soon. I'll play this whole track on the show sometime in the near future. And hopefully you'll be able to come back and visit with us and play some more records during your in-residency at Temple University. I had read that Lenny Tristano once told you that the hippest thing you can do is not play at all sometimes and just listen.
Oh, I think that was a great bit of advice. I really appreciated that. I had been out of New York for 2 years, just kind of thinking it over. My wife and I moved to California, and the pressures were so strong, we needed to do that. And when he called me and asked me to come back and join him for an engagement in New York, I really was a little hesitant to do it because I knew they'd be coming out to find out what I'd been doing for 2 years and all of that. And I remember going to see Lawrence of Arabia and getting there a day late. And I said, there are times, Lenny, when I don't really feel like playing and I feel like I'll interrupt the flow of the music. Could I just not play at that time? And he said, that would be the hippest thing you could do, just sit and listen to the music. And I said, well, thanks. That's about the nicest thing that a leader of a band could tell a sideman. And I told the kids that today when they were wondering why it didn't sound natural and feel good. I don't feel like you have to play for me. Just play when you feel like it, and it'll give me a great boost to hear a couple of heartfelt notes instead of a stream of mechanical notes. And so I really valued that advice very much. And I certainly have tried to do that in my playing, trying to get the bare bones part of my playing and get rid of the mechanical things that I learned early on.
So you're always trying to, like, pare it down and make
really
everything that you say more essential.
I played in Texas. If I got a minute for this anecdote? Last week I was playing with a big band, the North Texas State 1 o'clock band, and we were doing an arrangement by Bill Holman of Stella by Starlight, which I had played a few months earlier, and I was so enraptured at the beautiful sound of this arrangement, I felt no compulsion to have to do much of anything. I just ornamented here and there, and I loved it. And that felt real to me. And so that was, next time I play it, I might play 16th notes throughout it. I don't know. But at that time, it felt complete to me. So I did value that advice.
Well, I've really enjoyed meeting you and talking with you. And I hope you're not getting a cold, and I hope that you can come.
No way.
And I hope that you can come back and visit with us again in fresh air sometime during the semester.
Thank you.
While you're at Temple.
Really appreciate what you're doing.
Great fun to have you here.
Thank you.
And my guest has been alto saxophonist and composer Lee Konitz, who is in residence at Temple University in their jazz program this month. He'll be coming in once a week. And the last record that we heard, which is a recent record on the Soul Note label, is called the Lee Konitz Nonet Live at Laren. He has many other records on as well on several different record labels.